You are tuned to KDLL 91.9 FM, Kenai Soldotna. This is the Kenai Conversation. We are listening to a presentation by Sean Jakinski on growing perennial vegetables in Alaska. This was presented by the Homer Soil and Water Conservation District. They're doing a series called Know Your Lands. You can check them out on Facebook at Homer Soil and Water Conservation District. Back to Sean.
So now I want to move on to comfrey, true comfrey, Symphytum officinale. And if any of you were wondering what the true in true comfrey means, it just means that this is the non-hybrid version of comfrey and will set viable seed. Whereas say the Russian Bakken hybrids that a lot of people grow were actually bred not to produce viable seed. And I have to say, from my observations, true comfrey outperformed the Russian Bakkens in pretty much every way. Vigor, flower production, and leaf production here on the Kenai. Comfrey is very easy to grow. It likes full to half sun. It's pretty tolerant of drought because of its deep tap roots. And it's easy to propagate by seed, root cutting, and division. And it is a pretty prolific self-seeder. We keep a lot of comfrey in our gardens and a whole lot of comfrey in our gardens. And we use it in many ways. First of all, it's an incredible nectary with flower buds that open as early as late May and flowering continuously to late fall. Depending on the year, sometimes all the way into November. So we employ comfrey's ability to attract massive amounts of pollinators, particularly bees. Bees are attracted to them by including them in our small fruit orchards. So a large bed of comfrey, 16 feet long and 4 feet wide. And in the springtime, so all of the fruit is in full flower. There's black currants, gooseberries and red currants, bush cherries, or apples. And with this combination of plants in the springtime, the garden is literally rumbling with a wild mix of pollinators. It's a really glorious display. And thanks to all those pollinators, the fruit sets are always great. So one of my favorite ways to use comfrey is to plant it at the base of fruit trees, because along with acting as attracting those all of those pollinators, it also provides an automatic mulch. That is, it'll shoot up a dense clump of leaf and flower and then topple over, smothering all of the other plants below the fruit tree. And it'll repeat this up to five times in a growing season, enriching the whole ground with its nutrient-rich leaf as it goes. Another benefit of growing comfrey is that it has these long, tough tap roots that can easily reach 6 feet into the ground. It can access minerals and nutrients from the subsoil that many plants with shallower root systems can't access. Comfrey stores these hard-to-reach minerals and nutrients in its leaves, and comfrey produces a whole lot of leaf. Because of its impressive vigor, you can easily cut 4 to 5 bales of grains from a mature crown each year. And these grains can act as a super rich green manure that can be used as mulch or brewed into an odoriferous green manure tea, which is really simple. You just cut a bale of grains and throw them in whatever kind of container you got and fill it up with water. And in 3 to 5 weeks, stirring on occasion, you get this really, really potent comfrey tea. And you can use this full strength, but I would recommend by diluting it by half to make it stretch, and be careful because comfrey tea can get pretty stinky. So another way we use comfrey is as forage for our animal family. It's very nutritious. It's a very nutritious livestock fodder that contains 15 to 20% digestible protein, which is great because goats and chickens love it. We found that this is a treat best cut and served rather than freely available for unsupervised browsing, though, as both chickens and goats will have no mercy on the plants. So I'm just going to move on to Caucasian spinach. This is a really exciting plant, Simplicia tamnoides, that's the Latin name. It's interestingly, it's the only member of its genus. And as the common name implies, it is its place of origin is the Caucasus Mountains in Central Eurasia. But ancient garden specimens have been found further north in Finland and Sweden. We first learned about this plant about 11 years ago. It's a clump-forming herbaceous perennial vine that's hardy to zone three and has a preference for light shade. Propagation by seed is most reliable, but it can be propagated by carefully slicing clumps in the springtime. It is in the goosefoot family, and just like many other members of the family, such as quinoa, gudkeen, henry, and lamb's quarters, it's edible. And more than that, it's delicious. The edible part is the leaf. It's reminiscent of, the flavor is reminiscent of leaf lettuce and lamb's quarters combined. It's no bitterness, it's super mild. And the leaves maintain their quality even as the plant's in flower. We've been successfully growing this plant for about 6 years now. Took about 3 years of trying prior to that though. Long story short, one plant out of about 300 seedlings didn't make it. It's incredibly healthy, vigorous, and growing at the base of one of the three full-size alders in our sunrise garden. The placement, which is on the south-facing side of the alder, about 15 inches from the base of the tree, was without a doubt part of the plant's success, a large part of the plant's success. We shaped these alders so the south side branches and trunks are removed so they don't rob rainwater from the garden beds. So the Ablitzia receives a good deal of filtered sunlight, but never fierce direct light. It's like a warm, sunny shade. And the nitrogen boost from the alder, as well as the trunks and branches on which the vine can climb, coupled with the inherent vigor of the vine, all came together in a beautiful way. It's definitely seems like this is the way to grow this particular plant. One of the peculiarities about Helvetia is that for some reason in many gardens around the world, it's notoriously difficult to get viable seed from the plant. But I'm happy to say that we're actually, these last few years, we've been getting an increasing amount of seed from it. So we've been planting its babies. So this is really a testament to the cold hardiness of the plant, is that seedling overwintered out of the ground in a cell pack, just covered with a few inches of hay last winter, which is a pretty major winter, pretty tough plant. We've been experimenting with placements. We put in our greenhouse, which we found it works good. It comes back, but the leaves aren't as luscious and succulent in the greenhouse, I think because of the heat. We interplanted with Turkish Rocket, which was it kind of made it susceptible to slug damage, but it set seed its first year. Another plant I wanted to touch on is a perennial vegetable called Turkish Rocket, Spunius orientalis. We've been growing this garden plant in our gardens for 4 or 5 years now. It's an herbaceous perennial in the Brassica family. And just like Ablitzia, it has its roots in Central Eurasia. So you can see the plant, those lanceolate leaves that kind of look like a comfrey leaf or dandelion leaf. That's the Turkish Rocket. That's a second year Turkish Rocket that we had planted from seed that grew from our mother plant. The whole plant from the root up is edible. In early spring, the leaves of this plant are pretty delicious. They have a spicy mustard flavor and a slight bitterness that it intensifies as the season progresses. While the leaf is somewhat strong flavored, we do enjoy it cooked and mixed with other mild greens or shredded up for a mustardy kick on top of a salad or any meal. It's really drought tolerant. It does have really, really deep tap roots. You reach like 5 feet into the ground. And you can use the root like horseradish root, but not as spicy. But the most delicious part of the planter is its broccolis. So it's kind of like a perennial broccoli plant. They're harvested and prepared just like broccoli rabe, and it's like a perennial version, of course. They're really incredibly tasty stir-fried or steamed topped with a pat of butter and some fresh garlic served as a side dish. The flavor is a combination of cabbage and asparagus. And just like broccoli rabe, the harvest begins by cutting the central flower stalk, after which a number of mini broccolis will continue to form, shooting off from the remainder of the main stalk. Pretty beautiful and very attractive to the pollinators. We stripped off all of the balloon tips and ate the succulent stems, dry them and use them in soups to thicken soups. The just opening flower buds of our Turkish Rocket mother plant. And it took her about 3 years to set viable seed, but has done so for the last 2 years. She's the only plant of our original planting of about 20 Turkish Rocket seedlings that managed to survive this big vole year we had a couple of years back. And luckily she's managed to replace all of those lost plants and more. So once past the first year of its life, Turkish raquette seems pretty easy, a pretty easy perennial vegetable to grow here on the Kenai Peninsula. Prefers full sun, but will tolerate half. It's not picky about soil pH, and due to its taproot, doesn't require a whole lot of water. Incredibly, even though it's a brassica, it isn't bothered by slugs, which is awesome. One consideration is that it's showing the tendency to self-seed, which is great if you're looking for a lower energy way to expand your stock. If not, that's fine, because the best way to control the seed is by harvesting and eating those delicious broccolis. We're definitely planning on putting in a few more beds of this Turkish raquette. We just can't get enough of those broccolis. They're delicious. So moving on to the last plant that I wanted to talk about. Yet another exciting perennial vegetable we grow here in our gardens called sweet sisley or Myrus odorata. We've been growing this plant about 7 years now. It was one survivor, about 20 that we planted, and only three of the seeds planted, and only one of those plants made it. So a bit about the plant. Sweet sisley is an herbaceous perennial member of the carrot family that prefers moist soil and light shade, though the plant we have is thriving in full Alaskan sun. The plant is hardy to zone 3 and has proven itself for 7 years here in Inelchik. Mature plants, 2 to 3 year old plants, can reach 4 feet tall with ferny light green foliage that's covered in light fuzz, eventually forming umbels of white flowers in early summer that can easily reach 5 inches in diameter. The whole plant is edible and every part has a sweet anise flavor. You can eat the greens, the young leaf stalks. You can use the leaves as a sugar reducer and sour preserves such as rhubarb or gooseberry jam. And it not only does it reduce the amount of sugar, not only does it sweeten it, but it gives us this delicious anise flavor. Another edible portion of the sweet sisley is its green immature seeds. They're truly scrumptious. They're like this sweet, crisp, and licorice-y bite. It's quite a treat. And another delicacy is the root, which we have yet to try, as it is only this year that we were able to put in a proper bed of seedlings started from seeds that came from our original mother plant. The word is that the younger roots are most desirable. So first year roots, they can be roasted, stir fried, or even raw in salads. The most reliable way to propagate sweet sisley is by seed. It's important to know that the seeds must go through a period of cold, moist stratification. You can kind of do this artificially by storing seeds in a plastic bag with potting soil in your refrigerator for 3 months. We've tried this method with moderate success. But the most reliable way is to fall plant them outside and just let Mother Earth work her magic. We've also tried this method and found that viable seeds treated this way have a high rate of success, sprouting very early outdoors in the spring and leaving the refrigerator seeds in the dust. So this is the way to go. It's the best way to get the seeds going. You can divide the crowns. One important note that I would like to add is that to the untrained eye, sweet sisley with its ferny foliage and white umbelliferous flowers does resemble an incredibly poisonous member of the carrot family that is pretty common in South Central Alaska called poison hemlock. It pretty much resembles all the cicuta species. But once you become familiar with sweet sisley, it becomes very easy to identify with its fuzzy leaves and strong anise scent and distinct seed shape. But really, in general, it's always a good idea to carefully remove any poison hemlock from a garden plot that's meant to grow food. And it looks like that's the end of my talk. That's the summarized version. I would like to thank you all for your time and wanted to let you know that if you would like to try any of these plants in our gardens, I do have a limited supply of propagules that I would be happy to share. We have a lot of seeds and a lot of plants and just let me know. I'm always happy to trade for new plants as well. So if there's any time left, we can open up to questions and I will do my best to provide the answers.
Yes, Sean, you had mentioned where the Turkish raquette was from and the others, but you hadn't mentioned where the sweet sisley comes from.
Actually, unsurprisingly, it also has its roots in Central Eurasia. Of course, by its own efforts and the efforts of humans, it's spread all over the place. A lot of these old perennial vegetable plants have their roots in Central Eurasia. you know, but there are variations in different species of the plants and different uses that different cultures have. But yeah, its original roots are from Central Eurasia.
I'll ask a question. I've really been looking forward to this presentation, and this is fantastic. So many questions, but one would be, is ostrich fern easy to find out in the wild, and where did you get it?
Okay, so that's a very good question. On the Kenai Peninsula, there is only three places that I know where it is and where you can find it. It's usually pretty healthy populations. I'm not gonna give you the exact locations, but I will tell you to look on the north side of ravines, as well as flood flats at the base, like right around the bases of rivers, right before it rolls into the ocean. Those are two spots that you can check. Further north, it becomes more prevalent and easier to find, but they do have a pretty specific type of ecological nook that they like to live, where they like to live. So yeah, look in the flood flats and on north sides of wet, moist ravines. And they're often growing along in with cottonwood. In the flood flats, it'll be with like cottonwood, and they'll always have nettle with them. It seems like they're always associated with nettle. And they really like high shade. So that's why you'll see a lot of in cottonwood, stands of cottonwood in flood flats. The way you can find them is in early spring, is they have this one fertile frond that stays standing even through the winter. And it looks like kind of like a feather. And that's the frond, the spore producing frond. Where I have found them, they've been very numerous. So their populations are really healthy, but there's not a lot of them that I know of on the Kenai Peninsula, but you can go further north. There are other big patches further north in Alaska. But yeah, if you're looking for them, if you're hunting for them, you want to get your hands on some real native strain of the ostrich fern, that's where to look. Those are be my tips.
We have a question from Eric. Where do you like to get your seeds from if you don't have access to someone else's seeding plant?
So many sources, and they change from year to year. I mean, like as far as like common seed houses, Fedco Seeds is fantastic. Richter Seeds out of Canada is incredible. In fact, Richter Seeds was where I had got my original sweet sisley seed from. They do a really good job. I think they even have them pre-stratified for you. A lot of help that did, but we got one out of them. Another place to get really incredible seeds is Oikos Tree Crops, which is this really incredible nursery in the lower 48 that provides all kinds of plants, woody crops and herbaceous perennials, and focuses a lot on perennial vegetable crops and food crops in general. Another is more easy to find nurseries would be Rain Tree Nurseries, One Green World. I think it's called Strictly Medicinal Seeds or Bountiful Seeds. I can't remember exactly. I think it's Strictly Medicinal. Yeah, and then I also do a lot of sourcing from just independent seeds people that will be selling. A lot of the time, like there's this one guy in Poland that I've bought a lot of different seeds from with, you know, the varying degrees of success. And it's really just a matter of hunting them out. Perennial crops, you know, it's difficult to find certain types because they're not really, while there are a lot of perennial vegetables that are hardy to our zone, it's not necessarily something that a lot of seed houses or conventional seed, commercial seed companies will necessarily be looking. So you gotta find it and you gotta just do your best. But yeah, those are a lot of really good sources. It's a good start.
We had another question from Kyra, who was asking if you can speak a little bit about acclimating seed.
Yeah, I can. It's a really beneficial thing to have seed that has been acclimated to your growing zone. I mean, the difference between a seed that's been acclimated to your region as opposed to a seed that's perhaps, you know, in a lot of cases, in a lot of our cases, would more acclimated to the lower 48 is like the difference between light and day. Just like a simple example would be with this Hiblitzia. I planted at least 300 seedlings out of the, over a span of like 3 years. I tried to do this and I'd have plants that would either die in the winter, or which that was the majority of them, or there'd be the handful of plants that survived the winter and they would just put along for a couple of years and never really do anything and then die. But just that one seed, that one seedling put in the right spot, and just a single generation of acclimating has produced this one plant that's producing seed that almost all of the seedlings coming from this mother plant expresses the same vigor that their mother plant did. And that's just in one generation. So acclimating seeds is massively beneficial when it comes to any type of food crop. And there's a whole lot of considerations to take in mind. You know, if you're wanting to acclimate your own seed, selecting for characteristics that are desirable to your specific climate, your specific needs. One characteristic, say a plant that is showing the characteristics to be leaning towards more biennial versus annual in any situation, or perennial even. Like we've been doing a lot of work with red Russian kale. We have a second generation seed going that's taken years. Every year, we're just putting in a bed every year of seed that we grew, seed that was originally grown in Homer, actually, there at the homestead garden at the Pratt Museum. I had put in a bed of red Russian kale that overwintered, which is probably more common down in Homer, but in an Elchick, that's almost unheard of. So throughout this time, throughout these years, probably about 4 years now, this old seed I've been planting and letting them overwinter unprotected, seeing if any of them will make it through our winter. And last year, we had one out of probably about 40 plants that we planted to actually overwinter and put up a single seed stock and set a full and ripen a full little head of seed. Probably got 120 seeds out of this one plant. It's really exciting, you know, because that right there is an example of selecting for cold hardiness, ability to be able to overwinter. On the other hand, we've also been selecting plants, the kale plants that are exhibiting more of the characteristic to lean more towards annual, being as an annual, because that's really beneficial as well for us, because you know, we plant a lot of seed. So having a plant that completely bypasses the need, because kale is by nature a biennial plant, but there's all of the genetic variation. So we also have a whole nother lot of seeds that we've selected that are exhibiting more of the annual characteristics. That's really, really cool for us too. Smaller leaves, quick flowering and ripening seed in a single year, very early, cold hardy. It'll sprout by the beginning of May. There'll be little direct seeded kales popping up. So that's the two extremes of what acclimating can do. And you can take it anywhere you want to. Really beneficial.
John, going on that topic real quick, clarification on how you're acclimating these seeds. So you're talking about selecting seeds that have already proven hardy, but for those seeds that you want to harden up or get ready to be the perennial plants, is there any advice there? Like you mentioned that some you stick in dirt and put in the fridge, others you direct seed in the fall. Are there any guidelines you'd have for us?
Yeah, absolutely. So it just all depends on what the crop is. So let's say you're wanting to develop your own acclimated variety of whatever variety of carrot you're picking. You pick a variety of carrot, first of all, that's already proven itself in a single season. So you plant your row of carrots. In the fall time, you go in, you harvest your carrots, you look at all of the roots. You pick only the roots that you're very excited about, those roots that formed up to the size that you were hoping them to, or the largest roots, or that formed up the quickest, that tasted the best, and separate those from all of your other roots. Whittle it down to just six different actual carrot roots that you grew with seed that was grown, say, in the lower 48, most likely was. to acclimate, to get your own strain of that type of carrot, you'd have to overwinter that carrot in a root cellar, ideally, and then plant it the following spring, let it seed out. We've done this a lot, growing our own carrot seed. It seems to have pretty spotty ripening outside if you plant it outside, but if you get these carrots started in a greenhouse, you can do with this with beets as well. In a greenhouse, maybe a month before the last frost, expected last frost, to get those greens out, because they're biennial by nature, they'll be flowering that year. You have to stake the flowers, you put them outside, and let them grow throughout the year, or you can leave them in your greenhouse. Ideally, you'd probably want to keep them outside until the seed ripens. Then you have officially seed from a root that spent its whole life in the ground of your specific region. That's the beginning of your acclimation. You take the seed that you got from that plant. Again, this is like a whole year, a span of a year. It's a long process. Take that seed, replant it the following spring, and repeat that same exact process. After a single year, you're gonna picking from roots that have already expressed those characteristics that are most desirable to you in your specific situation, your climate. Well, already it should be exhibiting that type of characteristic that excites you about it. Then you do it again, and you do it again a few times, but even just doing that once. And honestly, you'd be surprised at how much seed comes off of a single plant. I mean, we'll do this with turnips. You can actually do turnips outside and plant them really early, as long as you overwinter them in a protected spot like a root cellar. Each plant is different, but that's the process for biennial plants. Process is different for annual plants. With annual plants, they're flowering in the first year. So if you're trying to develop an acclimated variety of lettuce, maybe that what you're shooting for is, you know, for production and vigor and quickness, maybe it's resilient to slugs or something like that. And also you're going to want to pick that plant that does all of that, plus will ripen seed in a single year. All of the seed, if you can get that seed ripened from an annual plant, that's your first step in acclimation. All of those seeds will be especially equipped to handle what their mother plant handled. Just in a single generation, you do that year after year. When you get into your third and fourth generation, if you continually do that, if you're lucky enough to have a plot where you're working every year, season after season, you're going to develop a strain of annual, biennial, or perennial plant that is specially suited to your situation. So that's the basic idea.
And that will do it. That was Sean Jakinski of Green Cannon Gardens in Nanilchik doing a presentation on Know Your Lands for the Homer Soil and Water Conservation District. They've got a series of these going on. You can check them out at Homer Soil and Water Conservation District on Facebook. You can, of course, find us at kdll.org. If you missed any of this Kenai conversation, we will post it on the website. Thanks so much for tuning in. This is listener-supported public radio for the Central Kenai Peninsula, KDLL, Kenai Soldotna, 91.9 FM.